Hello everyone, it's Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge. Thank you so much for joining us for our service this morning. We're really glad you're here. And obviously a new format today. We're beginning with our services held on Zoom. So I hope you are enjoying the new format and the way we're able to interact a little bit and see one another's faces. Please make full use of the chat facility that we have. And you get the chance to make whatever comment you would like to throughout this message. But just remember that I'm also on the Zoom call, so I'm watching you watching me. But when I think about it, that means that you're watching me watching you watching me. So it gets pretty weird. I don't really know what that means. But these are kind of strange circumstances, aren't they, where we're communicating via Zoom, we're holding virtual services. And just want to thank you for the patience you've had and the perseverance through these difficult times. But it's good to be together. And I'm actually, another first, just speaking to you here from our church auditorium. I'm inside our church building right now. And it's good to be here. It's, you know, it's such a familiar space. It kind of has this, I guess, this sense of history for us about it. And it embodies our story in many respects, because we've done so much together in this space. And I'm looking at the just like the walls and the banners we have up that that symbolize and represent the things that we really hold dear: hope, mystery, love, journey, grow, imagine, together, and serve. These kind of tell our story in many respects, say who we are, what we're about. So it's good to be in this space. And I hope that in this new format, we're feeling a deeper connection with one another. I know it's been a difficult last 6 months while we've not been able to meet together. Last week, I was actually looking back over the past 6 months and sort of had some reflections about the pandemic and these new circumstances that we're in. And what we're going to be doing starting today, beginning a brand new series called Reimagining Church, is looking ahead a little. We're going to imagine what it is to be church in these difficult circumstances. The series title is called Reimagining Church. But to look ahead, we're also going to look back, because what we're going to do is look back on our church history, which goes back 2,000 years. And we're going to look at the time of Jesus and those first followers, look at the time after Jesus when the church was just forming, and on into the first few centuries, and sort of look at what was going on there, because it very often was in extremely difficult circumstances, and yet they seemed to thrive. There was something just dynamic going on. So we want to look back and look at what we can glean from their experience, recognizing that it wasn't all perfect either. Look at the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you like, and then apply that into our own lives. And I think we've all had some of that experience ourselves in church, right? Church is not perfect. Church can be this unbelievably loving, kind, accepting place, a place of healing and reconciliation, but it can also be a place of discord and rejection and hurt and division. And I wouldn't be surprised if all of us have experienced both of those. You may have even experienced some of that at Cedar Ridge, because we're not a perfect church, but we're doing our best to follow Jesus and be a community together. And I think that's really what we're going to focus on today as we start this series, is we the people, is what we call in this message. It's like the church is actually, even though we love the space we have here in our property, it's not the building, it's not the property, it's not the money in the bank, it's not whatever other measure we want to use. It's us, it's people, and the relationship and the community that we have. And that's so important, because I think as we think about being church and doing church, we often think about community as a way to get things done. We need more people to do stuff, and if we need to work efficiently together to get the mission accomplished. But really, being a community is the mission. It's not the only thing about the mission, but it's not just the means, it's the end. In other words, as followers of Jesus, our community together, our relationships embody the way of Jesus. They embody love, acceptance, and forgiveness, healing, and reconciliation. And that's where the rubber hits the road, if you like. And today we're going to kind of wrestle with, what does that look like in the context that we're in at the moment, not just of pandemic, but a context where society is far from that. It's so polarized, it seems. So many different opinions, so many hostilely different opinions. And also a society that's so evidently broken. When we just look at the injustice around us, whatever our religious or political perspective, I think we could all agree that things are really broken at the moment. And we need healing. We need reconciliation. So we're just going to explore how can we be that as a church community, and in particular by looking back at the time of Jesus. Because there was something so compelling about the way of Jesus. When we look back, Jesus came into a context that was so itself so broken. There were so many different opinions. Jesus is he has this compelling vision for the kingdom of God, for heaven on earth, for a new way of life, a life that's healing for people, individuals, but healing for society as a whole. And very, very congruent with the Jewish concept of shalom, this state of existence, idyllic state of existence, if you like. And that was so compelling that it transcended religion and politics and culture and drew people from all sorts of different quarters. We've got to remember that the context in which Jesus came was at least as divided as our own one. They were under Roman occupation, and there was in first century Palestine, and there was all kinds of different perspectives on what to do about that. Some were saying, we got to fight back. Some were saying, we just got to keep going. Some were saying, we need to acquiesce and assimilate. And you have different religious factions like the Sadducees and the Pharisees with very different opinions within the Hebrew culture. You have the Zealots who are a political movement advocating violent uprising. You have the Essenes who are more about withdrawing from society. They had a very mystical slant on things. And then you have the Herodians. You have the Romans themselves. All sorts of different perspectives. And into that perspective comes, or into that context comes Jesus with this compelling vision. And it drew people from all quarters of life. People who would not naturally have got on, who would quite naturally have totally disagreed with each other. There was something about what Jesus was saying and doing and being that was so powerful, it drew them to leave behind some of their religious and political baggage to pursue this new vision of life that Jesus was bringing. Let's look at some of the scriptures that illustrate this. So, in Matthew's gospel, where we read about the first followers, the 12 disciples, as they've become known, it says this. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. And a few things we can note from this is, firstly, there's no women, but we're going to get to that in a minute. That's probably as much to do with the way this story is being told as the reality of who was around Jesus. So there's a little bit of patriarchy here, and that it's the 12 are all males. But look at the diversity even here that we have. We've got Matthew the tax collector and Simon the Zealot. Now, the tax collectors were on the side of Rome, or they were at least conspirators with Rome. They would collect tax for the Romans, and they were hugely unpopular amongst the Jewish people for that reason. Alongside Matthew the tax collector, you've got Simon the Zealot. Now, we're not exactly sure why he's called Simon the Zealot. It could be that he was a member of the Zealot party that were advocating uprising against Rome. Or it may be that he was part of a zealous religious group within Judaism. Either way, and we don't know for sure, but either way, the writer makes the point of saying he's Simon the Zealot, not just any old Simon. And being zealous in either of those two ways would have meant that he and Matthew would really have not got on and be coming from very different backgrounds, very different perspectives. But here they are in the group following Jesus. It's kind of like they've stepped into a common space quite incredibly, really. You also have, I think, what's of note here, you have disciples that nobody really spends much time on. You know, we don't really hear about them a great deal. People like Bartholomew, Thaddeus, you know, we all hear about Peter and James and John. So they weren't all like superstars. There's some fairly unknown people here too. There's a real mixture here. We also, I think, I want to read a section here from Luke, because coming back to the issue of the women that were following Jesus. In Luke's Gospel, in chapter 8, we read, "After this, Jesus traveled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him," so we've heard about them already, "and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases, Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, the manager of Herod's household, Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means." So that's a pretty dramatic list of, Mary Magdalene, who's had 7 demons cast out of her, make of that what you will. But then we've got Joanna, who was the wife of Chusa, the manager of Herod's household. So that's a very close connection to a household of Herod, whose dynasty had tried to kill Jesus in his infancy, and who were real enemies of Jesus. So that itself is exhibits the diverse sources of people who were coming to Jesus and joining this movement, joining and following Jesus. And we also hear that they're not only women, and it would have been just highly unusual for women to follow a rabbi like Jesus, to be in that entourage, just because of the way the culture was then. So this is a really diverse thing, incredible thing. But also, it says they're women of means. So they have money, and it's almost implying they're kind of financing all of this, and there's a great dependency on them. They're not just in the background. And we see here also how there's socioeconomic diversity in this group. There would have been people who, like, probably Peter and his brother and the other fishermen would not have been very wealthy, but these women are bringing some wealth. So there's all kinds of diversity. A few weeks ago, we looked at a passage where a Pharisee comes to Jesus called Nicodemus, who it does seem became a follower of Jesus eventually. So we have Pharisees following Jesus. We also read stories about there's a story about Jesus who heals a centurion servant, a Roman centurion who's said to be a follower. So we have pagan Romans, we have highly religious Jewish people, literate and intelligent people who have reached a certain standard of acceptance by society. Nicodemus would be an example of that again. Others who are most likely illiterate. Again, going back to many of the 12 disciples that we just read about would have been illiterate. So this is a diverse group of people, and it's really incredible you'd get that kind of a diversity in that situation. There was something so compelling about Jesus. Now, but it wasn't all plain sailing. It's not just a case that, well, just everybody followed Jesus, and so, that was bound to happen. It wasn't like that at all. In fact, in John chapter 6, we get, I think, a really defining moment, because Jesus has been talking about some pretty challenging things. And here's what it says in John chapter 6. "From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. 'You do not want to leave me too, do you?' Jesus asked the 12," so going back to the 12 disciples. "Simon Peter answered him, 'Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life.'" So it wasn't that everybody got it and everybody was in on this Jesus movement. Far from it. And obviously, as we see it played out, Jesus was eventually deserted by everybody, really apart from the women, in fact, and possibly John. But at this moment, when push comes to shove, it's a defining moment. Peter just says, "I've nowhere else to go. You have the words of eternal life." It's like nothing else will do. And that seems to be what keeps them in this community. There's something so compelling about Jesus. Jesus really is at the center of all this. Jesus, of course, was, he not just in terms of who followed him, but how he interacted with people. He interacted with women, with outcasts like lepers, Samaritans, people who were racially profiled and judged, Jesus interacted with a Samaritan woman at a well. Stories that we've looked at many times here at Cedar Ridge and are very familiar with. And it's just outrageous. It really is outrageous. And I think we miss some of that outrageousness because we're so familiar with it. I think also perhaps, you know, the way the stories are told does have, layers of patriarchy, right? So we've got, we hear more about the 12 who are all men. We don't hear so many stories about the women. But we get the impression, without, I think, connecting too many dots, that this was an outrageously diverse group of people, and Jesus brought them together. And I think we can take great courage from that, that it's possible, that we don't just have to fall back into our religious, political, or socioeconomic groups, that we can, that this vision to be a community that transcends all those barriers really is possible. Jesus did it. I think, you know, when we look at the community and what held the community together, clearly there was this compelling vision, the kingdom of God. But there was also something very incarnational about it. It wasn't just abstract and this inspiring dream. It was very real. It was very tangible, and that was. It was tangible because it was in the form of Jesus. There is Jesus actually living it, not just talking about it, but living it and being it, and showing people how to do it, showing people the way. And that's what I mean by incarnational. It's got flesh on it. It's real, and it's very relational. It's held together by love. It's not. There's no real hierarchy when you look at the way they were organized. Or doesn't appear to be. It's not about structure. It's about love, and it's about mutual responsibility. Everyone playing a part. Everyone giving and taking, and clearly at times some people gave more, and at other times other people took more. That seems to have been the case with Judas, for instance. But he was part of it. He was included in it. So just an incredible vision and an incredible incarnation of what it means. To be community together. But I want to come back again to the fact that it wasn't perfect, right? There was struggle in all this. And I think it's important that we see that because I think we struggle, right? We struggle with unity and accepting people with different opinions and how can we be a church community that welcomes different opinions and perspectives, but still is cohesive and has cohesion. They struggled with it. It wasn't all easy, and I think we get evidence of that through conflict. A few weeks ago, we looked at the story of Peter's conflict with Jesus, where Jesus says to him, "Get behind me, Satan," because he's kind of in a way tempting Jesus to give up on the way of love and pursue a way of resistance and violence through violence, whereas Jesus is all about love. So there's conflict they have, and that was uncomfortable at times. There's competition. They were constantly is probably a bit of an exaggeration, but very often we're told as readers that they were arguing about who's the greatest. And sometimes Jesus says, "Hey, what were you talking about back there?" And they are embarrassed and ashamed. It's almost like they know that's not the way, but there's this competition amongst them. We get... I think a great glimpse of that in Matthew's Gospel chapter 20, where James and John, the sons of Zebedee, their mother comes to Jesus with a request. Here's what it says there in Matthew 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, kneeling down, which is a mark of respect, and asked him a favor. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left hand in your kingdom." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father." I think what we're getting here is that their view was that Jesus' kingdom is going to be all about power and success and victory, and we want in on this. So, you know, we want a high place at the table, one at the right and one at the left hand. I'm sure that's metaphorical language, but we want to be key players in the winning team. And Jesus is saying, "You don't really get it, you know, and can you drink the cup?" In other words, Jesus, we'll get onto this in a second, Jesus saying, you know, suffering and loss is going to be part of this way that I'm pursuing. It's not how you think it's going to be. And they're confident they can drink the cup. And he's saying, well, you're probably going to have to, but I don't think you know what's coming. So there's this sort of uncomfortable competition going on. And even not just conflict and competition, but breakdown. We have the story of Judas, who betrays Jesus. Peter, who denies Jesus. All of them, pretty much, deserting Jesus. So it wasn't all plain sailing. It was messy. The mistakes were made. But Jesus kept going through it all. And let's face it, with the exception of Judas there, they kept going through it all. And we'll hear more next week about what it looked like when Jesus was gone, and they kind of took the baton and picked it up. But Jesus' response to the messiness, I think, helps us see and define what the way of Jesus is all about, and what makes this this way so special. In the messiness of it all, and let's look again at that passage in Matthew 20 where Jesus responds to James and John's mother. Jesus goes on immediately to say this, and perhaps another bit of context here is that when they are asking that question, you know, sit at the right hand and the left hand, Jesus has just been talking about his death. So it's ironic, it's almost inexcusable. But Jesus then goes on to say, or it says, when the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. So, you know, they're mad, probably not because they think, oh my gosh, you know, how could they possibly think about being the greatest? They're mad because, hey, they tried to get in before we did. So Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So here we see Jesus really laying out the different way. If you like, laying out what's going to be the secret to this diverse community, what's going to hold this diverse community together. And it's not going to be control. It's not going to be conformity. It's not going to be some kind of structure. It's going to be servanthood. That's the sort of giving in to one another and deferring to one another is going to be the way that we move forward. Now, I think it's important to say here that that doesn't mean that everybody has to agree or that we shouldn't have an opinion. And that, you know, clearly there were disagreements and different opinions. But it's talking about the way we deal with those disagreements and the way we'll deal with people who come from a different perspective from us or from a different background to us, a different context. And that is the way of servanthood. It's a valuing and respecting and deferring to the humanity and the sacred sense of self in another person. And of course, Jesus, you know, modeled this and demonstrated this for us. You think about it when he was under the great threat, when he's spending his last night with the disciples before he goes for trial and judgment and execution. He in John 13, he washes his disciples' feet. He shows them, this is the way I want you to be with one another. When he's in the context of having been denied by Peter, let down terribly, and Jesus meets with Peter and the others, but sort of singles out Peter right at the end of John's Gospel and says, well, let's look at that, actually, that those verses. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. So here we have Jesus defining how this community, this diverse, often difficult, broken community is going to be held together. And it's through love. Love is the core. Love is the center. All Jesus is worried about here is, Peter, do you love me? There's forgiveness and healing and reconciliation and acceptance. Is love what's going to motivate and drive you forward, Peter. And hence Jesus saying, feed my sheep, be love to other people, love embodied as servanthood. And this is the currency of the community of Jesus. This is the, our currency as followers of Jesus. And I think we lose sight of how outrageous that is, how challenging that is, because it's so familiar to us. I mean, I don't think any of that really sounds that shocking. And as we sort of wrap up here, let's just perhaps look at some ways we might apply this into our own lives. I would say check out the discussion questions, because they're going to that accompany this message. They're going to dig a little bit deeper into some of these issues that I'm going to raise now. I'm just going to make 4 points, which I don't think sound all that outrageous. But I think that they're hugely challenging, though, especially if we think about being a community, being a diverse community, and being that community in the context of a society that is so divided and so polarized. The first one is this: you belong. That might be a struggle for some of us. I know that's been a struggle for me at times. You know, we can feel, perhaps when we think about the spectrum that I talked about earlier of followers of Jesus, we might feel we're on the end where it's like, yeah, not very well known, not that much use, not I've got a lot to offer or whatever. But whatever we feel about ourselves, maybe it's we don't feel we've got our opinions would be accepted, or we have different opinions to the mainstream of the community, or whatever it is, you belong. You belong because Jesus is our center, because we're following Jesus, not because of your opinions or because of your religious convictions or your political convictions or whatever they are. It's because we're all in this together following Jesus. You belong. The second point, though, is kind of the flip side of that, which is everybody belongs. And that becomes, I think, almost a greater challenge. Is like, am I prepared to accept other people? People who I disagree with, people who, you know, I have different perspectives with. And will I allow love to help me rise above those differences? It doesn't mean letting go of our convictions. It doesn't mean compromising. We see in Jesus a very uncompromised person. Jesus, who in John's prologue says is full of grace and truth, full of love and truth. And Jesus, as we were seeing in a series we just did recently on uncomfortable conversations with Jesus, Jesus would speak truth to power, to people who were abusing power in a very uncompromising way. He'd also speak to the powerless and give them a new narrative, a different kind of truth. So truth was really important to Jesus, but it's in the context of love. He did all of it in the context of love. And so can we hold our truths, but in the context of love and acceptance, in the context of servanthood, where we believe the best about others, and we see others as fellow pilgrims, fellow travelers who haven't got it all worked out yet, and we're willing to accept rather than push away or vilify. And that's a struggle. I think, especially when it comes down to religion and politics, those things in any community, especially religious communities, can be a real struggle. So that's, I think, a big challenge for us. Is servanthood the way? You know, would we say that servanthood is what's driving us? Is that our currency? Again, I think we'd probably all say, well, of course it is. You know, we're followers of Jesus. But are we willing to embody that acceptance of others in the way that we act, the way we behave, with the way we treat other people? In other words, is love the greatest? I mean, does love beat being right? Let's look at 1 Corinthians 13, this beautiful passage that the Apostle Paul wrote, which we're so familiar with, again. But I think, you know, if we were to think about what I'm about to read now in the context of some of the differences we have with people, or how we feel about ourselves or how we feel about others, let's sort of read this with that in mind and feel the challenge of it. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not eagerly angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. And then at the end of the chapter, it goes on to say, and now these three things remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. The greatest of these is love. Is love the greatest in our lives, or do other things take priority? Do other things overcome us and sort of suppress that love? I think that's a huge question for all of us to wrestle with. And then the final point is it requires huge courage to pursue this way of love. Means we're probably going to get hurt, we're going to get misunderstood, it's going to get messy. It'd be much easier just to join communities that are just like us, where everybody believes the same thing, everybody thinks the same thing, everybody's coming from the same perspective. But that's just not going to bring healing. That's not what's going to transform the world. That's not Jesus's dream for the earth. That's not Jesus's vision for the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of heaven on earth. And so by following Jesus, we're taking this huge risk. We're following in his footsteps because he took huge risks. And we're saying it's possible, that healing is possible, that no matter how bleak it may seem out there, that we can come together in love. I think of the vision that Martin Luther King had for the beloved community, that it's possible. And that's only going to happen through love. It's not going to happen through hate. It's not going to happen through control or power. It's going to come through the servant-hearted way of love that Jesus modeled for us. So I hope that's been helpful. As I said, probably nothing particularly remarkable there, but perhaps can help us get back to our roots of kind of why we're in this, that it's about us as people being a community together. Next week, we're going to look at the early church in the first few years after Jesus and some of the challenges that they faced and what it looks like trying to live this out. And it gets even messier, really, in many respects, but it's super exciting and all kinds of amazing things going on. And we'll talk about what it looks like following Jesus in really unusual circumstances. But do check out the discussion questions for this week. Dig a little deeper into those. We're going to take communion now. And communion, of course, is a time where we come together as one body. We celebrate our communion together. So let's just take a moment and quiet our hearts. And then Kevin and Gina are going to lead us in communion.